And this is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. And today we're talking about all things coronavirus, the vaccines, variants, and the coronavirus's effects on Indiana Public Health. If you have questions or comments on our show today, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. That number is 866-476-3881. You just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. And you can also send us high-quality voice messages with our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. You just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Now, today, we're joined by three guests from Butler University. Mark McBeth is an assistant professor of chemistry. Ogbenaya Omenka is an assistant professor of health sciences who is currently researching the work of frontline health workers of color. And we also have Christopher Stobart, an assistant professor of biology who has studied the structures of coronaviruses for almost 10 years. Thanks, everyone, for being here today. A lot to talk about today. Chris, I wanted to start with you. And like I just mentioned, you've been looking and studying the coronaviruses for a long time. What are some of the things that you've learned? And I guess what's been the most eye-opening?
Yes, it's really been interesting watching how coronaviruses have changed over these last 20 years, to be honest. 2002, 2003, we had the SARS epidemic that emerged. And at that time, up to that moment in time, actually, coronaviruses were considered quite benign. They were mostly associated with the common cold, and there wasn't a ton of people working on coronaviruses. But then when this virus emerged in China 20 years ago, and we had this new pandemic potential that could be associated with coronaviruses, it put the world on notice. And then a decade later, we had this Middle East respiratory syndrome coronavirus, or MERS, emerge. It had an alarming 35% mortality rate. I think what's most surprising to me and through our research and to the coronavirus community right now is just how many different surprises can be dealt by one family of viruses. These viruses have jumped from species to species, and each virus, despite the fact that they're all coronaviruses, has their own unique characteristics and properties that define them. This new virus, for instance, is the first primarily asymptomatic spread coronavirus that we've had, which is why we've seen such a high level of cases and increased mortality compared to earlier coronaviruses. But each virus has its own unique properties, and as we study them here at Butler, and as other coronavirologists across the country study them, it's become very apparent that as we continue to learn more about these viruses and they adapt in front of us, there's a lot more to discover.
Right. Like you said, they do adapt. I mean, viruses, obviously, they change and they evolve over time. What are some of the recent variants that have been reported, especially here in the U.S., that you know of?
Yeah, so the two most common variants that people are talking about right now are this UK and South African variant strains. And I think it's important to note that it is normal for a virus to adapt and mutate. This is something the viruses do by just their general mechanisms of replication. Viruses make mistakes when they copy their genomes, and this is where mutations come from. And a variant is just a virus form that has a mutation that makes it subtly different because a mutation's affected some structural or functional property it has. These UK and South African strains that are now in the United States have mutations that are located in their spike protein. This is the protein the virus uses to attach to our cells. It's also the protein that our immune systems respond and try to block. And so these mutations have given the viruses the ability to spread better than the original isolates or strains of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. And with those mutations and modifications, there's also this concern that since they are in the same protein that our immune systems respond against, and the vaccines have tried to prime our immune systems to respond against, that there may be lesser efficacy of vaccines for protecting against these unique and new isolates.
You know, I think hearing about these new viruses can frighten a lot of people.
Yeah, there's a lot of concern right now, and especially in the public health community, because what we're seeing is, as you've reported just moments ago, there is a lot of states and there's a lot of government agencies are talking about laxing standards. And right now, in Indiana, we're at 540 new cases a day. And that may sound like it's an accomplishment because we were at one point in the thousands per day. But the reality is this is where we were in July of last year, right before this whole big wave came in the fall and into the winter. And if people start relaxing standards and not wearing masks with these new variants that spread more effectively, and potentially can cause more harm to people, there's a major concern that we could completely rebound and be right back where we were just months ago.
What about the vaccines? Will they have an impact on these new variants?
Yeah, so the good news is Moderna and Pfizer have already been looking at these new variants. And the data that's coming out of those early reported studies, we haven't seen a lot of scientific papers yet, peer-reviewed papers yet, but the early data that's coming out suggests that even though the vaccines do not protect as well against these new variants, they protect enough and provide enough protection that even if you've been vaccinated and were to contract the UK or South African variant, you should not see significant disease on a case-by-case basis.
Okay. And Mark, since you're an assistant professor of chemistry, can you give us a little bit of the science that occurs within the current COVID-19 vaccines, since we're talking about the vaccines right now?
Yeah, right. So these, the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines are really interesting. They're the first sort of widespread use of these RNA-based vaccines. And there's been a lot of questions of, so what is RNA and what does it do? RNA is basically a molecule that helps us translate an instruction manual that's written in DNA into a functional molecule of a protein. And so it basically translates that DNA language into a protein language. And the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines contain an RNA that carries those instructions for the coronavirus spike protein that Chris mentioned a few minutes ago. And really what we're doing is we are trying to entice our cells to start making this spike protein by giving it this instructions in the RNA. And that's an important concept, is that we're not getting injected with a full virus, coronavirus. We're just getting injected with that one small piece of information to get our cells to make the spike protein. And when our cells do that, it triggers an immune response. And that immune response, part of that immune response is to make molecules called antibodies that will sort of neutralize that spike protein, right? And the key here is when we're exposed to a coronavirus in the future, our immune system remembers how to make these antibodies so we can make them quickly and neutralize the spike protein that's found on that coronavirus that we've been exposed to. So that is how the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines work, using this RNA technology. But yesterday, I believe it was, or maybe 2 days ago, Johnson & Johnson received authorization to distribute their vaccine, which is the same idea, to try and get our cells to make the spike protein, but there's a different delivery mechanism. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine uses another type of virus called an adenovirus, which has been inactivated. An adenovirus, the adenovirus strains that they use typically infects chimpanzees, but again, they say it's replication deficient. The adenovirus cannot replicate once it's inside our cells. But they use this virus to deliver the DNA for the spike protein. So when we get that shot in the arm, the adenovirus gets into our cells. The virus dies away, but it transports that DNA into our nucleus of our cells, where the RNA for the spike protein can then be made, and then that RNA can be translated into protein, into that spike protein, to trigger that same type of immune response.
You know, the science can be a little complicated for a lot of people, and I think a lot of people just want to know, what are the side effects of the vaccines?
Right. So the immune response, the first immune response that we generate, it's called the innate immune response, and it's nonspecific. It's the innate immune response basically says, okay, there's a foreign object that we're making, this viral spike protein, and so we have to sort of try to destroy that. And so the immune response, all kinds of mechanisms, small molecules, small proteins, to try and get rid of that spike protein. And those are responsible, that immune response that innate immune response is responsible for our side effects that we feel. We might feel a sore arm. We might have aches and pains, a low-grade fever, maybe a headache. And it's those side effects that we're feeling. And that means that the vaccine is working, though. And so that's a good sign. It's the same effects we feel when we're actually exposed to the virus, right? We mount that immune response to the virus, and it makes us feel under the weather, aches and pains, fatigue, fever. It's the same thing. It's the same principle. But with the vaccine, it's only going to last a day or so, and then you're going to start to feel better right away. The long-term protection, the antibodies that are made, that kicks in about 3 weeks down the road, where we start to make these antibodies that are specific for that spike protein to prevent us from infection from future exposure.
I know some people, too, want to know which vaccine they should get, and do they have a choice, and does it matter?
The recommendation is to take whatever you can get. And, you know, it's sort of putting it bluntly, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, you may have heard, it's slightly less effective, but it's still very good. It's very good efficacy. And what's important is the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, its efficacy is excellent at preventing serious illness, hospitalization, and death. And so that is what vaccines are supposed to do. And so whichever vaccine is available, I recommend, and the CDC recommends getting whichever one you can. It's the number where that people sort of note that maybe it's a little bit less effective. It's still about 70% effective, which is still very, very good.
I'm sorry, that is
going to protect you from moderate illness.
What was the percentage of being effective?
I think it was about 70% effective against moderate illness.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, we'll talk more about the vaccine, and we also have some questions from listeners, but we'll be right back with our guest after just a quick break. We're talking about COVID-19 vaccines, the variants, and Indiana's public health during the pandemic. Of course, if you have questions or comments for the show today, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. That number is 866-476-3881, 866-476-3881. I'm Taylor Bennett. We'll be right back. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Well, today we're talking about how COVID-19 vaccines are working and if we should be worried about the coronavirus's variants. We love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from. That number is 866-476-3881, and you can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. You just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we will try to get it onto the show. Well, we do have a question from Joe on Facebook who asks, there is a lot of concern and anger among people with disabilities, that the majority of people with disabilities, they've not been really a priority under the state's vaccination plans. For example, I know one woman with a spinal cord injury whose immune system is compromised and getting the virus and dying from it. And what data is the state using to exclude these people with disabilities from vaccination when they have compromised immune systems? And Ogbenaya, I think I will direct that question to you.
Thank you. Well, there is no way during a public health emergency or crisis that it is possible to address every affected group. And because of this, usually in public health, we say that we have two approaches to addressing a public health crisis. So the first is the at-risk approach. And so usually since the COVID-19 virus started, you hear people saying essential workers. So basically that is derived from that at-risk approach, meaning there's some type of rubric, and this may vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, to be quite honest, but the overall idea is to derive some type of priority list based on how and where and whom the public health threat is mostly affecting. Now we have the average approach whereby, and I'm using the kind of like the layperson term, but the idea behind that approach is let's apply kind of the same approach based on what we have and hope that over time, the average effect will be felt in the population. And then going back to this specific question about people with disability, it's really tough because the clash between clinical aspect of health and population aspect of health, that's exactly exemplified in this question. So basically what that is when we're dealing with clinical health health outcomes, how do we balance that with population health outcome? Because when it comes to clinical, you're dealing with the individual, whereas in population health, you're dealing with a whole group of people or groups of people. And so then the effect with the individual aspect of health is kind of like very more discernible to the common eye. So it's more observable, or it's easy for you to say, well, I got vaccinated or I got treated. But at the population level, it takes a little bit more time and patience because the effect kind of becomes accumulative. So it's easier to kind of get discouraged, if you may, in terms of the population health approach. So while there's no magic bullet, but this is just to point out some of the challenges every health system or every public health system in every state has to deal with. Yeah, so there's really no easy way to resolve this, but a lot of times it's usually just resource, it's mainly driven by the available resources and how many, how much personnel can help to get these things done.
Right. As a state overall, what is the COVID-19 case numbers right now?
Well, at the moment, compared to 2020, obviously, the numbers are lower, but there are a couple of things that I want to point out. So when you look at the daily positive cases, I think if you look maybe between the last 48 hours, it's almost 600 compared to, November 2020 when it was in thousands. And then if you look at the daily deaths, we are at close to almost a double digit, but not quite. But again, in December, it was over 100 per day. So looking at these numbers, it's clear that there's a decline in both cases and mortality. But we must be careful here because these numbers are not live, and they kind of, there's a lag in terms of, us knowing how the gains or the losses. Another thing to keep in mind is, and you've heard a couple of my colleagues say something about the new variants, it's important to leave that room because we don't know exactly how the new variants are going to shift, the scale either way. And another thing also, if you look at the current numbers that I just mentioned now, and you look at the same time in 2020, it is clear that although the numbers are coming down, but they're still higher than where we were at this time in 2020. So to the common eye, yes, the numbers are coming down, but if you factor in all of these other components, it is probably more obvious or a better idea not to, give in to that caution fatigue, because it's understandable that, a lot of people just want to get out of this. But one thing I must say, though, when it comes to the vaccine and using those essential public health guidelines, I would recommend that we try so hard to deviate from looking at it from an either-or perspective. Either I follow the public health guidelines, or when a vaccine is available, then I'm. But I think it's better to look at them as both. We need a mixture of the public health guidelines and while the vaccines are being rolled out. So because both of them will actually allow us to get out of this as fast as possible, as opposed to relying on one or the other.
So would you say then it's really too early to say that there is light at the end of the tunnel?
There's always, it's hard to imagine any infectious outbreak that doesn't end. But in this case, I would say it is even more encouraging now that we have a vaccine or different options for vaccination. And so with exactly the point I was making, if we can keep with the public health guidelines while also trying to ramp up the vaccinations, I think those combined will actually give us the more readily observable light at the end of that tunnel.
Okay. Well, state health officials announced that residents 55 and older are eligible for the vaccine. So it seems like the age rollout is moving quickly. Do you think Indiana is doing a pretty good job on the vaccine distribution?
That's a mixed bag question that I'm going to try my best to unpack in just a few minutes. So yes to the first question. I commend, you know, everybody involved from, you know, the health department to all of the unsung heroes. Yes, the efforts in Indiana have been commendable. But I must point out that, again, using one factor to kind of assess how the overall population is doing could be tricky. And so while we are recording great success, or at least a significant success in terms of age-based rollout, that's still not, that hasn't spread to the overall population. And the reason I say this is we are, the population of Indiana is over 6 million. And then if you check how many doses we've already had so far, and just speaking strictly about first doses, because again, the full dose is only when they complete the second dose, but just focusing on just the first dose, we have a little bit over a million people who have got their first doses, and in Marion County, over 115,000. Now, out of everybody who's got their first dose, 87% of those are in the white population. And then the white population in Indiana comprises 85% of Indiana population. Now, when you look at the black population in Indiana, they comprise 9.8% or thereabout. But then the percentage that have already or that have been vaccinated at this point is only 4.5%. So that is not even up to 50% or half the general population of the same group in the general Indiana population. So only when you look at these numbers do you begin to realize how much, how wide the disparity, which we've been talking about health disparities in Indiana, and even the, Governor Holcomb, you know, set up a health disparities committee. And so these are kind of the layers we need to peel away to understand exactly. But yes, to your question, Indiana has been pushing hard to improve their rollout, but it's not, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, I do want to talk to you in a little bit about some of the work that you're doing, researching the work of frontline health workers of color. Mark, though, I did want to ask you your thoughts on the speed of the COVID-19 vaccine production.
I think the production in general, what has been accomplished in the past year has been astounding. You know, as someone who works in, you know, in the lab and in science, you know, his entire life, it's just I'm constantly impressed. You know, but it's also important to remember that we're not cutting corners. You know, the vaccine's still going through all of its trials that need to have been gone through. And as I'm sure Chris Stobar would mention, you know, this is a culmination of decades of research. So we really maybe shouldn't be so surprised by how fast these vaccines have come down the pipeline. But again, you know, I look back in all of the papers coming out in the past year, it's really is impressive. As far as the rollout of the vaccines into Indiana, it's, you know, the more the better. And I'll agree with Dr. Omenka that, you know, we can always do better and we can always go faster. But yeah, so far, so good. And the more people getting vaccinated, the better.
Right. Mark, we have a question from Judy on Facebook who asks, if one does not have side effects from the vaccine, what does that mean regarding how effective it is as far as on an individual basis?
You know, that's a good question. We always hear about the side effects and the mm-hmm. negative aspects of them. So from my understanding is that the side effects from the first dose of the RNA vaccine are relatively minor, but we do are trusting that it's working, that, you know, that RNA is getting into your cells are making the spike protein, and you're generating that immune response. The second dose, from my understanding, is the side effects are usually worse or a little bit more severe, but again, still relatively short-lasting, a day or so of feeling sort of under the weather. If you do not feel the side effects, I would not take that as a bad sign as it not working, but it is a good question.
Yeah, I mean, you wonder. I mean, if you haven't had any side effects, you've been pretty healthy, you wonder if you do have that immunity toward it.
Yep. And so I think that we can test. It's sort of testing the, we call it the titer of antibodies. We could check that. But I do just, I think that we are going to work under the assumption that, yes, you know, your body's immune response is working and you are generating these antibodies for protection.
How long would the vaccine last? Should you get it more than one time? I mean, I know there's two doses, but should you get it like every year?
Well, you know, that remains to be seen. We're going to have to, it's like science, that's, these answers are going to come after a year has passed to see, do we still have antibodies present? And do we still have the cells that can make these antibodies that remember how to make them present? And the jury is still out. I believe, and Chris, I'm sure, knows better than I, the antibodies from the SARS-1 epidemic from the early 2000s lasted, I think, 3 to 5 years, or the cells that made these antibodies lasted 3 to 5 years. So I'm guessing it's going to be in the same ballpark, and maybe Chris could comment on that.
Yeah, because Chris, you've researched the coronavirus for, like we talked about, for a long time. What is, as far as being similar in difference between COVID-19 and the other coronaviruses like SARS?
Yeah, the antibodies from the SARS, from people who survived SARS-CoV-1 back in 2002-2003, those did last for a number of years. And it's important to note, though, that that virus caused a more severe illness comparatively to what we're seeing with SARS-CoV-2. Remember, that mortality rate for SARS-CoV, it was closer to 10% of people who got that virus died from it. So, and remember that the way their immune system works, as you've heard from my colleagues here, is, you know, our immune system sees the virus, it recognizes it, it remembers what it sees, and it produces these molecules, antibodies, to block that virus if it ever sees it again. And the more virus you see, the more robust of a response your immune system's going to have against that virus, that specific antigen. To go to what Mark was talking about regarding how long will these vaccines last, I can tell you the technologies that are being used here are likely to induce antibodies that will last at least a year. And we know for sure that the vaccines, at least in trials, those people who have been vaccinated have maintained protection to date since they've been vaccinated. So they're going to have protection for at least a lot longer time than if you got a natural infection that had no symptoms at all. So we know it's asymptomatic people who've had COVID, that those people, their antibodies might go away after 3 or 4 months because they didn't see the virus as much as our immune system see this virus pathogen component in these vaccines. So to answer how long they will last, well, it's hard to know because honestly, the virus vaccines have been developed so quickly that we have not really gotten a good time frame away from the first administration of these vaccines to know how long they'll last. But I'm encouraged by previous studies and with coronavirus studies in the past that if these antibodies are there and they're protecting and they've been elicited, they will last for at least a year or two at minimum. And the hope is that if you combine that vaccine protection with good public health protection efforts, social distancing, wearing masks, that that combination will slowly squeeze this virus away from continuing to infect new people.
You know, I think that's why a lot of people are so concerned about the vaccine. Like you just mentioned, it was developed so quickly. So they're wondering, is this really going to be effective and does it really work?
Yeah, the technology that's being employed here, it's a combination of new and old. You know, when the first SARS coronavirus emerged 20 years ago, approximately 20 years ago, we started at that time developing vaccine technologies for coronaviruses. And so a lot of those ideas, a lot of those philosophies regarding how we elicit protection, how we get our immune systems to respond to the virus, a lot of those things were already being thought of, developed, and investigated by scientists in laboratories, 10, 15, 20 years ago. When this virus emerged and this pandemic emerged, this is not a surprise to coronavirologists. There's 7 human coronaviruses that are known now. This was the 7th that emerged. And 3 of those, and I've already talked about SARS, MERS, and the SARS-CoV-2, 3 of these pathogens have emerged in the last 20 years. So the idea that we have a new pathogen that's a coronavirus emerging and causing significant disease or even becoming a pandemic isn't too surprising. I think what has been the most surprising aspect of this has been just the nature of how well this specific coronavirus has spread. And those vaccines that have been developed over the last 20 years what happened here is we took existing technologies, existing information, and adapted that to this new strain. People I know are concerned about how fast these have been developed, but realize that there was a delay between when these were developed and when they went into people. And that's because we had to wait on clinical trials. And you heard about these clinical trials all through the end of last year. And we're still doing trials. We're still looking at the data as it comes in, as people are being vaccinated. So you know, these decisions of approving vaccines took time. They required looking at a lot of data, checking over things. And the FDA would not have given approval, and our government would not have given approval. And that's a panel of scientists looking at data would not have given approval had they not had those clinical trials present and had the data in hand to make those decisions. So I do trust the data, and I trust that these vaccines have the safety profile. And I can tell you that data coming out so far on these vaccines, I mean, nationwide, we've administered millions of vaccines. There's a very low rate of significant effects by these vaccines due to reactions.
Okay.
So we're a really good safety profile.
All right. Well, we'll be right back after a quick break. We're talking COVID-19 one year later, vaccines, variants, and the health of Hoosiers. I'm Taylor Bennett. Again, we'll be right back. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Well, back now to our discussion on COVID-19 vaccines, the variants, and public health. Ogbenaya, you are looking at some research here on frontline healthcare workers of color. What are you finding so far?
Well, thank you. The first thing is, before I, you know, address that, I just want to say that this is not just the regular research in terms of just answering a question. In this case, there's a whole lot of reasons why this is necessary. So first, often, you know, when we hear or talk about public health threats and how they disproportionately affect certain demographics, such as minoritized racial and ethnic backgrounds or people from those backgrounds in the U.S., sadly, the conversations usually seem to end there. So it's essential that we begin to peel back the layers to kind of better understand the underlying factors. And so back to your question, according to our preliminary data, and let me just point out that I'm working on this with two of my colleagues at Indiana University. So our preliminary data currently kind of confirms some of the things that we already know. And when you do research in health disparities like I do, you begin to kind of foresee some of these trends. And so in looking at the data, you kind of shake your head and say, yep, I expected that. So for example, when we talk about frontline health workers, they're more likely to be the same people who are more disproportionately affected by COVID. And according to research, actually, before this study, we knew that healthcare workers from minoritized racial and ethnic backgrounds were more likely to care for patients with suspected or confirmed COVID-19 cases. And as a result, they're more also likely to report using inadequate or reused protective gear. And because of all of these, they're more likely to test positive for the virus. So again, back to our study, we are getting some of those confirmations in terms of availability of resources, administrative support, toll on mental health, and even people in relationships who are kind of explaining how this has, you know, adversely affected their relationships. So, again, these are just preliminary data, but these are kind of predictable because the reason I say this is, and I teach public health, so I tell my students this, every time there is a public health threat, it doesn't matter what it is. It could be a tornado or a tsunami, power outage. They tend to toll the already existing disparities. And so nothing about this COVID in terms of how it's affecting people is really new, because when we have another public health challenge, if we don't fix the same structural or systemic issues that contributed to how this COVID-19 has played out, we will still come back to these same conversations about who it's affecting more disproportionately and all of that. So this is just one way my research is playing a role as a form of advocacy. And so just a couple of things else to say. This is also necessary for policymakers, because a lot of times we know these problems anecdotally and we know them emotionally, but then again, we need to speak data because when we talk about policy making, they rely a lot on numbers. So this would allow policymakers to understand better the problem and how to develop appropriate policies. And also even healthcare administrators who often, make day-to-day decisions, they would have some way of having a better idea, not just talking to their employees, but having an idea. Because again, research allows these participants to be kind of neutral or de-identified, if you may. So that way there's kind of that fear of retribution or some kind of retaliation is removed.
But it's very important research. Do you hope to present this research and the findings to public health officials and also policymakers?
Yes, that's the goal. So the three aspects of this, to disseminate it within the scientific community, that way to, because it's unrealistic to expect just one people or three people or just one group of people to carry all the weight. So that way, other professionals who might be inspired or they might have similar or even just, have an offshoot idea. And then so we kind of spread this out. So that's the first thing. And the second one, policymakers, they need to hear this, or at least somebody from the policymaking background needs to kind of have access to this kind of information to be able to share it with, the other members. And then, of course, the actual population that are, like the actual frontline health workers, knowing that they have a voice. Because, again, when you look at since the COVID-19 began, even in terms of the optics, when we see the teams that have been working to help us to address the problems, you see that the efforts haven't really been representative, at least to the public eye. And, my colleagues have talked about that, and you even mentioned something about, vaccine hesitancy. There are some low-hanging fruits of, we can't take advantage of to kind of maybe claim some of that lost trust, within these communities in terms of the government's response to the problem.
What about your students? Do you think there's more passion for them to do good work, especially those that are going to be studying or are studying public health?
Yes. So this is something we do actively. In fact, some of them are probably listening to this interview. And so what I do, I usually just, when I'm done with this, I bring the content to class and we dissect everything. I hear their feedback and then we go through some of the other aspects that, may not even be in their textbooks, because applying what they're learning in class in real life has already started bearing fruit this semester alone. I've had a few students come to me wanting to switch their, their academic goals to a career in public health. I've written a lot of recommendation letters already this semester. So I can already see that the students are inspired, especially since this COVID began. Recently, one of the students, because I taught him about epidemiology, or we started looking at how to study an infectious outbreak, looking at the distribution and the determinants and all of these factors. And, this shoe leather epidemiology, trying to ask the right questions and playing kind of like a cop, investigating an outbreak. And so one of them already thought, okay, I didn't think I wanted to be an epidemiologist, but I actually want to do it now. So it is really, it's great to know, but I would love to get to the point where it's not due to the pandemic that the students are learning about the importance of public health.
It is inspiring, though. Mark, what about you? What are some of the special skills that you see your students are going to be getting that they can take with them?
Right. So, we our undergrad students in our department and in the sciences in general are all active in the research lab. And so, they spend around 5 hours a week in the lab doing experiments. And in my specific research group, they are at the bench. They are looking at protein molecules. They're looking at RNA molecules and how they interact with each other. But the idea is to sort of look at it analytically and think about it critically. And so they can apply what they're learning in classes to these research problems that they're facing in the lab, and hopefully bringing those skills with them, when they leave here and go to graduate school, medical school, other health professions.
Chris, when we look at this whole thing, what do you think can be done to prevent something like this pandemic from happening again? I know that's a pretty broad question, but you have any specifics that you can share?
Yeah, I mean, the good news is, and this may sound bad in some ways, but it is good news in the big picture, is we're dealing with a pandemic. But, you know, in terms of the pandemics of past in human history, we're not seeing the level of potential death that could occur. I mean, the Black Plague killed 1 in 4 people that it impacted. So, you know, we're seeing a situation where we can actually look at our existing public health system, look at our hospitals, look at our scientific community, and evaluate where we are. Because the reality is there will be future outbreaks. There will be most certainly future coronavirus outbreaks. And we need to be ready for those. And so are we ready going forward? Where are we sitting today? Obviously, some things have worked well. Some things haven't worked as well. But we're also all going through this the first time in our lives. I mean, the last time we had a pandemic anywhere near this scale was in 1918. Not many people today are alive who would have, you know, would have been around for that pandemic. And so as we're exploring this new space, I think it's important to recognize that, first of all, first and foremost, if we're looking at what we've done well, science has put us in a position where we've been able to develop a vaccine that is going to have very real effects on our population in a very short period of time. And it's backed by science, and we're able to distribute this vaccine and potentially arrest this pandemic a lot earlier than it would have been had we not had the vaccine. We are very much more aware now of the potential for coronaviruses. And I think existing infrastructure, which will develop from this outbreak and this pandemic going forward, will allow us to be better prepared for the next outbreak and the next pandemic that can occur. You know, whether it be government agencies who are doing surveillance, whether it be public health officials who are already ready to go, having backup plans and having emergency planning lined up in light of another pandemic, I think we're going to be better prepared going forward. And I look at that optimistically, that might better prepare us to handle what could be in the future even a worse pandemic than what we're dealing with today.
You know, Texas lifted its mask mandate, and they're not going to require, you know, what I think is probably has been one of the most effective ways to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Do you think that's a good idea, Chris?
I do not. I am very I'm very disappointed that happened. And I'll tell you that the main reason why is, as I mentioned before, right now we are where we were in July of last year. And if you look at the charts, July is where things started to build. We still have enough cases and enough people infected nationwide and in a state-by-state basis that if you remove the public health efforts, if you remove, for instance, mask wearing, social distancing, if you start allowing large occupancy events at locations, all you're doing is throwing wood on the fire, because there's enough virus already there that it's going to be able to spread. The goal of a virus, in simple terms, is to replicate, and is to spread and replicate as much as possible. And if you allow those barriers that are preventing it to be removed, you're just allowing it to take back off. And a lot of people are thinking, well, right now the vaccines are working. The vaccines are working. The drop we're seeing right now is likely not due to the vaccines so much as it is just us coming off of the holidays, where we really ballooned in cases. And if we think that we're eliminated this virus and it's going to go away, I'll tell you, look at the trends. The last 7 days, we're leveling off. We're not dropping anymore. And if you remove those things and say the states of Texas and Mississippi, where they're removing some of these standards and these protective devices, those states are going to start seeing cases that balloon and expand. And unfortunately, other states near them and nationwide, as people move around this country, are going to continue to see this thing explode.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. How much longer do you think, though, that we'll have to wear the face coverings and just practice social distancing? Do you think that's going to be a way of life for some time?
I think we have to accept that as a population, we will need to continue to use some form of mask wearing and social distancing until a large enough part of the population has been vaccinated. You've heard this term herd immunity, the idea that enough people have been vaccinated or have protection that the virus cannot efficiently spread from person to person. And we know that number is likely to be somewhere around 70% of the U.S. population will need to be in some form protected in order for this virus to not be able to continue to efficiently spread from person to person. Right now in the state of Indiana, we're about 10% vaccinated. And if you add to that some percentage of people who've naturally acquired the virus, we're nowhere near 70%. And really, the question is for the people listening, you may or may not agree with the principles of wearing masks. You may or may not agree with vaccines. But until we as a population reach that threshold, we're going to continue to have to live in this reality. So you can join the club, wear your mask, get vaccinated, or you can continue to fight it and just delay and prolong the reality we live in today.
You mentioned herd immunity. Will we reach that eventually?
I do believe we will. Inevitably, you'll get herd immunity either through natural infection, that is catching the coronavirus, or you'll get herd immunity through vaccination. Some combination will get us there eventually. And this is why nearly all pandemics come to an end in some form and in species. So we will get there. The question is how fast we get there and what is it going to take for us to get there?
Mark, what are your concerns as far as when we return to what we call normal?
I think one of the things that we still are unsure of is how well we can still transmit the virus after we've been vaccinated. And so the current recommendation is even though you've been vaccinated and you've developed these antibodies, you'll be protected, but you should still continue to wear your masks and continue to social distance because we're still not certain of how well we can still pass on the virus to someone else. The virus can get into the mucus layer in your lungs, and you could still coughing or transmit it by coughing or expelling water droplets. So even though you've been vaccinated, you should still continue to wear your mask. And that's sort of my biggest concern. I don't want people thinking that, okay, I'm you know, immune. That's good for me. You still have to take these precautions to protect the larger community.
Do you think there's any correlation that the cases of flu are down because we are wearing masks?
I don't know. I only know anecdotally. I teach a large undergraduate class. I get sick every year. I haven't been mm-hmm. sick yet this year, knock on wood. I don't know, but it makes sense. You know, you have this mask on. You are not expelling these water droplets. You know, we are getting, I got my flu vaccination. I'm certain that helped, but I haven't even been sick. I like to think that the mask helped with that.
The mask and hand washing and social distancing,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, we have to wrap this up pretty quickly, but what do you think is one of the biggest lessons that you think we'll take away from this?
I think the biggest lesson is, for me, more foundational than anything else. And so the reason I say that is if we can focus on strengthening our public health systems, because we are only as strong as our weakest links in different states, in multiple states. And I travel around the country a lot and I see so many places that have dilapidated infrastructure. And I teach these things also to students. And sometimes they're shocked when I show them even in, you know, pictures, because as I mentioned earlier, it's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. We're going to come back to these conversations about population health and a public health crisis. And so then if we can resolve these seemingly endless friction between, because we do have a market system, and I teach this in class as well, so it's a fundamental challenge. We have a market system, and when we have a public health crisis, it requires some kind of social justice or equitable approach, but that is incompatible with the market system, or at least the pressures of the market system. And you just mentioned Texas lifting, you know, and even without or before these masks, right? There were the states to talk about reopening. So the pressures, the economic pressures, sometimes push it.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I want to thank all of our Butler University guests for taking the time today. A lot of great information. I appreciate it so much. I'm Taylor Bennett. Thanks for listening. This is All In.